This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi! This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And today I'm going to have a poem because at the bottom of the hour, because it is April and it is National Poetry Month, so every program, I'm going to have a poem. Today's poem is from Jim Lamb, who has a book out, and we're going to be talking about that a little bit. It's called Dark Fruit, and he will read a poem for us at the bottom of the hour. But right now, I get to turn to something. Oh, this is so much fun. Well, I love books that have food in them. And so this one just turned out to be, well, this is something really special. I'm so really happy to welcome Leslie Karst to Joy on Paper. And the name of her book is Justice is Served, A Tale of Scallops, the Law, and Cooking for RBG. Wow, this is exciting. Hi, Leslie.
Good morning. If I sound a little bit like Lauren Bacall, it's because I'm in Hawaii and it's 5 a.m.
Oh, wow. Oh, well. What are you doing to us?
Hey, Lauren is not bad.
No, it's not bad. And I'm up at 5 a.m. every morning anyway, so but what a place to be. Okay, well, this is so exciting. When I got this book, I thought, this was so clever of you to come out with this idea. You have to tell us about it. And for people who don't know who RBG is, explain, how did you come out with an idea that turned into this marvelous book that you've written?
Well, it came about because it actually happened to me. My father was a law professor. And he had known Ruth Bader Ginsburg back since the late 1960s when they were colleagues together. And over the years, they stayed in touch. And he was teaching at the UCLA Law School. He was about to retire after 40 years, and he had been trying to get RBG to come and speak at the law school every year. But, you know, she was on the Supreme Court. She was pretty darn busy, and she kept putting him off. And finally he wrote and said, Ruth, this is my last year if you want to come at my invitation. And she said, okay, I'll come. And he told me this. And I said, oh, my goodness, Daddy, if she comes, you should let me come down and cook dinner for you and Mom and Ruth. And I thought sort of it was kind of a joke. But he said, oh, that's a great idea. And I went, uh-oh, what have I just gotten myself into? And, you know, because I was actually a small-town attorney at the time myself and wasn't a professional cook or anything. I had been to my local community college cooking school, and here I was having just agreed to host the most, fabulous dinner party of my life, and it was rather daunting. So anyway, it happened, and it turned out great.
I thought it was wonderful. That's what a dad would do. I mean, your dad
exactly.
Always has faith in you. Your dad doesn't even question it. It's just automatic. Absolutely.
I know, it's true. Oh, boy. So, anyway, after the whole thing was over, I had never thought about writing a memoir about it, but after it was over, we were driving back up home, up into Northern California, and it was like, wait, I should write all this down. It's pretty amazing what happened, because it wasn't just the dinner itself, which was incredible, and getting to sit down with Ruth and her fabulous husband, Marty, and to dinner that night, and my mom and dad and my partner Robin and 5 U.S. Marshals in my parents' den. And I realized it was something I really needed to write down. So as soon as I got home, I wrote everything down I could remember from what happened in the months leading up to it, the night of the dinner, all the conversation. So that was very fresh in my mind. And then it sat on my computer for many years before I actually went back to it and turned it into the memoir that it is now.
Well, you've written it beautifully, and it is such a wonderful story. And I think it's so heartwarming. It's a kind of thing that when you get an idea and something just works out so beautifully, and yeah. In this case, it's just what a thrill, really a thrill of a lifetime to have. The thought of it, you know, it just makes me so excited. And I was, wow. And as you said, you wrote the story, and I'm sure you talked about it over the time to people. Everyone wanted to know more.
Right, it's true. And that was one of the reasons I decided to go back to it. And actually, because it, when I first wrote it all down, it was just the facts. I wrote down everything that had happened. And then I needed to turn it into a memoir, because it had to be my story of how it affected me. And it did. The event really affected my life in ways that, if you'll read the book, you'll learn. And so I had to weave all that into the story. And then I realized that it was also not just a memoir about me. Of course, it was about RBG. So I weave, each chapter has what I call little interlude section, where I put in things about her life, her personal life, her legal life, and in ways that are easy for somebody who's not a lawyer to understand. It's written in a very conversational tone, the whole book.
It is. I love these interludes. I will tell you, they are just delightful, because you read them as you're reading the book, but then I found myself going back and reading the interludes again, because I thought, oh, this is all stuff I wanted to know, and then you're giving it to me.
Yeah, little tidbits about her life and why she's so important to our legal system, you know, specifics about what it was she did, but also lots of fun things about cooking, because the book is as much about cooking as it is the law. In fact, it's an interesting combination. I can't think of any other book that's a combination of law and cooking.
No, I couldn't either. And I thought, oh, I just love it, because, as I said at the beginning, I love books where there's cooking. I remember the first time I read the Year in Provence, and there's food.
That.
You know, I just food. It's got food in it and wine. So
in France.
Yeah. So I'm happy, you know. And so it's the same thing here, but also the excitement.
Mm-hmm.
It's so ambitious what you did here, because you know, it's not like you just had them over and, you know, did the you weren't going to do, you know, grilled cheese sandwich and tomato soup.
So, right. No, it needed to be it truly was the most important dinner party I've ever thrown and probably ever will in my life, and so the pressure of that was rather great. Not to mention the pressure of, you know, I started thinking, well, here I am, I'm this small town lawyer, and I'm going to be having a whole evening with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. What if she wants to talk law with me? And that was terrifying as well.
But so many things just turned out perfectly. Of course, her husband also loves food.
Artie, what a sweetheart he was.
Yeah, and what he loved cooking, because I think she was busy a lot. She was a pretty busy person.
Yes, he was a famous attorney in his own right, and also loved to cook.
Yeah.
So that was fun getting to meet him.
And
the recipes are in the book. The recipes of all the food I made.
I was going to tell everybody the recipes are here, and it's in an ambitious menu. And tell us about how you and Robin decided to you got together, put your heads together, and said, "Well, we better think about this menu."
Yeah. Well, Robin didn't have a whole lot to do with the menu, because she like Ruth isn't much of a cook. She does the dishes though. I had to come up with an elegant, tasteful, varied menu that could look good on a plate, but that I didn't want to myself spend the entire night in the kitchen. That would be crazy. I have this opportunity to spend time with these two amazing people, so it had to be something that could be mostly prepped in advance, and that I could just finish up, as they say, à la minute, in the kitchen for maybe five minutes. So that I wasn't constantly there. And so I did, a lot of that was what went into my thinking. And, as you read the book, I go through this process of angsting and analyzing and trying to figure out, trying out dishes. Oh, this is great, but you have to spend too much time in the kitchen, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it was a delicate balance, I'll tell you that.
It was, and it's so much fun. I loved all of your experiments and your testing and deciding, I don't think so. We're not going to do that one. I mean, that's I love, when I was younger, ambitious, in Europe, when I lived in Europe, we did dinner parties a lot. People just did dinner parties. Here in America, they come over for a barbecue. So it's not so much, you know, sit-down dinners. And when I was in England, I did a lot of dinner parties. And it was, and I enjoyed it, but boy, there's always that that little tight thing in your stomach that says, "Oh, why did you agree this time? Don't you ever learn?"
Yeah, I know, it's true. I was really lucky because growing up in the '60s, my parents did have dinner parties, and so I grew up around that culture, and so my entire life, not in college, but as soon as I moved off campus, we started having dinner parties. They weren't that elegant when I was in my 20s. But then as I got older, and then, of course, when I went to cooking school while I was working as an attorney. Yes, a little crazy. And so I wanted to experiment with the dishes I was learning in cooking school. So I actually, that was nice that I did have that experience of throwing dinner parties. And I still do. I think it's a wonderful...
Oh, it is. It's wonderful.
It's a really wonderful culture that we could stand to have more of in our life, where we actually sit down and put aside our devices and talk about what happened in the day with each other.
Exactly. I think now after the pandemic, people really, I think, would appreciate if people would start having dinner parties again, because it is just wonderful to sit down and to talk and to actually, you know, enjoy your food and not be rushed and not have those devices anywhere near you.
Right.
But
it doesn't have to be fancy. It could just be something simple, but... to stop and sit down and break bread together is a wonderful thing.
Well, your dad must have been, the pride.
He was pleased. He was very pleased with it. And he loved to have the chance to spend the time with Ruth, too, because they hadn't been great friends. They lived across the country. He was in Los Angeles and she was back east. And so for them to have, I have this wonderful photograph of them during the dinner where they're leaning in and both smiling and talking about the law, and they're just so happy. It's really precious.
Well, I think it's beautifully written. Well, of course, the wonderful thing, lawyers are always good with words, and that's one thing. Even if you're a small town lawyer,
I was a research and appellate attorney, so that's what I did for a living, was write. Plus, I came into this memoir having already written, I write a culinary murder mystery series as well. And
I was going to mention that.
so I had written those. It's the Sally Solari mysteries, which are set in California, and she, her family owns restaurants. And so I had those under my belt. But, you know, writing a memoir is really different from writing fiction, because you have to write about yourself, and that's scary.
Well, I thought you did it so well. I liked the trip to Paris.
Yes, me too.
Tell us a little bit about that research that you did there, because you did do some tasting here.
I did. Well, it was just kind of a coincidence that the day that I found out that I was indeed going to cook dinner for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it was the morning that Robin and I were about to leave for a month in Paris. And so it was great because my trip to Paris gave me a purpose in life. Not that one needs a purpose to go to France, but but we spent, you know, we went to many restaurants, and every time we ate a meal, I would look at the dishes and think, could this work for the dinner? And I would try things out and talk to people. And I actually, in the book, you'll see, I did throw a dinner party while we were living in Paris and invited some of my Parisian friends over to taste the food and see if they thought it would be fit for a Supreme Court justice.
it was a great opportunity, really. Just it gets you excited when you're in Paris, because you taste the cheeses, you sort of your taste buds are reawoken, you know, in
yes,
ways that you might not have at home, because when you taste things in Paris and you're like, is this really bread? I mean, it's just bread. Why is it so great?
Oh, boy, that bread and the baguettes you get in France.
it's amazing.
Oh.
Or when you
you're
walk
being
into
cruel now because I don't have one here. Now you're making my mouth water.
Or when you walk into a cheese store, you know, I tell people, well, they have like, you know, for people who haven't been to Paris, they say, well, one of my favorite places was to walk into the cheese store, and they say, a store for cheese, a store just cheese. I said, yeah, it's just cheese. How can you have a store for cheese? I mean, they go down the aisle, you know, the dairy aisle,
exactly.
And they see everything in plastic. That's not how it is in Paris.
Yeah, I think that might be my idea of heaven, is walking, dying and going up to heaven and walking into a cheese store.
It's such an experience, and we also used to do like a month in Paris, because you really need a month in Paris, you mm-hmm. know. You have to just be there. You have to be part of it, and so you get to know, you know, the people in the little stores. That,
exactly,
It just makes, it's something.
And so you can walk around and walk off some of those calories you get from eating all that cheese.
Well, that's true. And actually, that's what you do in Paris. You walk.
And everybody does. They walk. Yeah.
Miles and miles and miles. I don't think any place I ever, you know, I took hikes in Yosemite, but boy, oh boy, did I walk Paris.
It's true.
And the hills, up the hills.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And up the stairs, when you go to those stairs and you climb up to Montmartre.
Right.
Wow.
Oh boy. That's
yeah.
View in the city, though. Worth it.
Isn't it? So I got a kick. I mean, so the memoir turned out to be not just about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and giving us so much. I love all those stories. I don't know how you collected all of those sort of more personal stories, mm-hmm. But those are fascinating. And then just to see your life, and I just kept getting a kick out of it. How my dad would have gotten a kick out of me making a dinner for somebody important like that. And your dads are wonderful, aren't they?
They sure are. And yeah, you saying that brings a smile to my face. He passed away a few years ago, but as did my mother. And this book is, it's wonderful because they had a chance to read the first draft of it, obviously, because I wrote it many years ago. But it's kind of an homage to them, and it's dedicated to them because they both play a big part in the book.
Yeah, that's I wanted to say that because I think it is so important that you know, they knew that you were going to do this, but they were there. They saw.
They were there.
They saw this fantastic, I mean, everything from scallops to roasted squash soup, a very good selection. I love that. I love that.
Yeah, that soup is delicious.
Yeah.
And by the way, the recipe is, it looks complicated, but it's actually quite simple to make.
Yeah, and it's wonderful. For people who haven't had it, and your recipe is excellent. And then all the other things that you did, you know, of course, I think always having fish is good, too. So you had lots of things, and her husband actually gave you a little bit of information about what they'd eat, right?
Yeah, because you can't, one thing, if you're hosting a dinner party, you can't prepare something that somebody might have an allergy to, or if they're gluten-free or whatever. And so Marty and I had a lovely series of emails back and forth before the dinner, talking about food and other things, which is when I first realized what a charming, lovely man he was.
Well, and it's wonderful, you know, you have to set up the atmosphere. You selected just the right look for it, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep, my mom helped with that, because the dinner took place at at my childhood home where I grew up.
Wow. Oh, I think it's just a beautiful story, and I hope people will, you know, really... sometimes when people do spontaneous things, they get an idea, like you did, and it works out. It just, it gives me such a thrill when something like that happens.
It's true. I mean, if I hadn't blurted out, excuse me, that sentence, this whole important piece of my life would have been missing. So it's true. That's a good point. If you want to do something, just go for it.
Go for it, because you never know. I mean, you know, you might have decided to make a souffle, and it might have...
Oh, goodness.
I did that once when I was young. I said, Now, I knew how to make a souffle, and I had practiced from the time that I first saw Audrey Hepburn in Sabrina. I mean, I wanted to learn how to make a souffle. So when I moved to England and I had a lovely, you know, I had a lovely kitchen, and I was great at souffles. And I said, this is nothing, you know, souffles. But boy, to serve it for a dinner party, that's...
Because it's all about timing.
Yes, timing. It's timing.
Yeah, it's all about timing. And dinner souffles are all about timing, as are dinner parties. It's like working in a restaurant. And that's what makes a dinner party different from just cooking for, you know, yourself. You need to things be finished at the correct time.
But your menu turned out to be perfect. The recipes are in the book, and that's wonderful. I really think that you did a great job with this book. It's lots of fun. We learn a lot about the law, because, as you said, you talk and write about her cases and about her background in the law. My goodness, mm-hmm. She was... It was amazing, everything that she did. when you look back on it and you say, "Wow, this she was something," you know.
She was amazing. She was a truly astounding human being in many, many ways.
And so there you are, having dinner with her. I get such a kick out of it. It just, you know, even now after all this time, I get such a kick out of it, and I think that it's one. I think everybody who reads this book will get the same thing. Wow! Yeah,
well, something, thank you so much.
Something like that. So great. So it is a great book, and it's Justice is Served: A Tale of Scallops, the Law, and Cooking for RBG, and it's by Leslie Karst. And Leslie, how are you doing? What else are you doing? What's happening with you?
Well, to tell you the truth, it's about 5:20 a.m., and I'm probably going to go back to bed after this for another hour. But no, I'm doing great. I live half time in Hawaii on the Big Island, and then half time in Santa Cruz, California, where I'm returning in a couple of weeks, and I'll be there all through the summer and fall. I'm working on my next Sally Solari mystery, which comes out in August. It's okay. Called A Sense for Murder. And so, yeah, I'm keeping busy writing and
well, we'll have to
cooking.
You just have to let me know the date, your release date, and you'll be back here on Joy on Paper, and we'll talk more about cooking, more about the joy of writing. Okay,
that would be lovely. I would love that, and thank you so much for hosting me today. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, it's a lot of fun to talk to you. I love people who are enthusiastic, and that's you.
Me too, and you too as well.
Okay,
thank you so much.
Okay. One question. Do you have a what do you call them?
A website. Facebook? I do indeed. Yeah. It's just LeslieKarstAuthor.com, and it's LeslieKarst author.com.
Okay.
But if you just Google my name,
it's easy.
Leslie Karst, it comes up.
It comes up, and people can find out more. And people
they
start...
can find out all about the Justice is Served book, and not to mention my mysteries. And hey, if you there's a menu that says songwriter, and you can listen to some a CD I recorded back in the 1990s, a country rock CD.
Okay, well, we're gonna have to play some of that when you're back here in August. How about that?
All righty.
Okay, bye bye.
Thank you so much. Bye bye.
It's been fun talking to you. Bye. Whoa. Okay, let's play, we're going to just play a poem by Jim Lamb. Jim Lamb is, of course, people know that he does the literary gems here on Joy on Paper. He's also a poet, and he has a book out called Dark Fruit, and I want to play his poem, and then we'll do Devon's Book Buzz, and I'll be back after a little while.
Love in a Cup by J.S. Lamb. Coffee, dark sparkling brew, good with donuts, pizza too. Comfort, as you touch my lips, cozy warmth with every sip. Nectar from bygone days, fine old friend in every way. Coffee, sweet sparkling brew, what would my day be without you?
Oh, I love that. I'm going to think about that while we play Devon Miller's latest Book Buzz.
everyone. It's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Talk Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. It's a new year, so what better way to start the new year by reading a new book? Unsure which book to read? Don't worry, Stacy has you covered. Stacy is the character from the brand new book, Stacy's Remarkable Books. This, based on a true story, was written by Stacey Abrams and illustrated by Kit Thomas. Stacey's Remarkable Books tells the story of Stacey, who loves getting lost in her favorite books. Stacey eventually meets a girl named Julie, who has little trouble reading in English. Together, they start sharing books so she can practice, and the rest of the students in their class join along. Almost 10 years ago, Stacey Abrams received an unexpected note from Julie, thanking Stacey for her friendship and how they were able to bond over books. It was this friendship that became the basis for the book. Already the number one new release for children's books on girls and women's issues on Amazon, Stacey's Remarkable Books is the companion to the number one New York Times bestseller, Stacey's Extraordinary Words. It's a tale from Stacey's childhood about the power that books have. When reading this book, I think this book will have the power to bond people together, just like how Stacy and Julie's friendship stemmed from a bond over books. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
Commercials. Okay.
Is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi! This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. And I am so happy because I'm going to be talking about Texas, and I love talking about Texas. Donaldson Brown has written a book called Because I Love You, and I love that title. Hi, Donaldson.
Hello, Patsy. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, that's so good. You know, sometimes a book comes along at just the right time. I've been thinking a lot about Texas. I lived there for a long time. And I, you know, just love when I read your book, you just brought back all those memories of being in Texas, being in horse country. Now, I don't ride, but my sons ride, and one of my sons particularly loves riding. And so, I've been around the horses. My husband could ride, and his mother rode. His mother was a great rider. But I enjoy people who love horses.
Well, I enjoy people who love horses, too.
And so you certainly know how to write about Texas.
Oh, well, thank you. I actually grew up in New England in southern Connecticut, but my father and his siblings actually had a ranch in northeast Texas, and pretty much out in the boondocks, you know, just kind of at the bottom of the Ozarks, and I spent time there as a girl and as a teenager, and it was very impactful. It was just a beautiful part of the country, and of course I was horse crazy from the time I can remember, so yes, it stayed with me for sure.
Well, tell us about this love story. And it's delightful, it's charming, it's sort of heart-wrenching all in one, and I think that as we've come out of this pandemic, I think more and more people sort of are taking a breath and saying, yeah, let's think about love stories. And I'm really enjoying the ones that I've been getting lately. And this one I thought was so, it had this extra horse lovers part that I like. And then, of course, art, too. So right. Tell us about your characters and how you came up with the idea.
Sure. Well, the story opens in 1972 in northeast Texas, as we mentioned, and really against the backdrop of the Vietnam War. And the main characters, Lenny and Caleb, are teenagers when they meet. They're 16 and 17, and they're really kind of drawn together by their love of horses, and they recognize in one another their horsemanship. And that's what brings them together. And then there's both families are going through some difficulties. Caleb's older brother has just returned from Vietnam, and he's changed. He's having a difficult time adjusting. And then there's a tragedy that befalls Lenny's family that I won't divulge here. But both of them, Lenny and Caleb, also both really have ambitions and dreams that would take them beyond their small town. But after this tragedy, they have to make decisions that really will reverberate through their lives, and it takes them apart. And then the novel picks up again in New York City in the mid-1980s during the downtown art scene boom, and also the simultaneous Wall Street and real estate boom in the city. So it's kind of this heady time in New York City, if you will. They meet again.
We can't really say too much because wonderful, both eras, 1972, and the people coming back from Vietnam, of course, and so many did have a rough time, and so many did come from small towns. So there's a lot of this small town background in the story. People who want to get out of the small town, which is funny, you know. Of course, I was from a very small town, and I was the same way. From the time I was 11, I decided at the age of 11 that not only was I going to move out of town, I was going to move all the way to England.
That was it.
I said, no, I announced it when I was 11. I said, I'm moving to England. And I think my older sister said, and this is funny now when you think about it, she said, what do you think, you're a princess? but I did. By the time I was 21, I had saved up enough money, and I moved to England. So did you have this angsty feeling too as a child?
I did. But also, I love your story, and I think one of the reasons that I started the novel when I did, well, the real reason is because that's when Lenny first came to me. She was a 16-year-old running away on her horse. But I think that sometimes the ideas or the passions, the dreams we have when we're very young can really hold a key to who we are. And so I love that you at 11 you knew that you wanted to jump the pond and go to England, and you did it. I think that's fabulous.
Well, mine was thanks to National Geographic, because we were very poor, very poor. The only thing that we got was somehow my dad signed up for the subscription to National Geographic. And when that magazine would come every month with the yellow border, it was like I was bored again each time it came. And one day I read an article about Jane Austen and England, and that was it. I knew where I was going. So, and it turned out that's exactly what happened. So
I love that. It gets better and better. I also remember the National Geographic's coming to my house. Yeah, it was fantastic.
they did. They really opened our eyes to the world and made us, for those of us who read it and started dreaming about going away, going to places.
Absolutely.
So tell us about Lenny.
Well, Lenny is, she's the youngest of three. She has an older brother, Foy, and her brother, Marguerite. And she's crazy about animals and her horse. And she's really kind of a tomboy. And she also really dreams of being an artist. She's just drawing all the time. She always has her sketchbook with her and her diary. Her father is a veterinarian, and she adores him. And she will often go out with him and sort of help on the weekends, help him on his, you know, his visits. And her mother is actually a French war bride. And she came from Normandy, France, and met Lenny's dad when he was there during the Second World War as a medic. And she was taken a little bit by surprise, Lenny's mother, when she, I think she thought she was marrying a medical doctor and came back from Normandy, France, to ranching country in Texas and found she was married to a veterinarian.
It would be a little bit shocking. I look at it from that point of view. It would be a little bit shocking to come from Normandy and land up in Northeast Texas. I mean, like,
well, yeah, you know, one of the stories I remember, my uncle, my mother had a brother, and my uncle met his wife when he was in the service. He was home from World War II on leave, and I remember my aunt telling me one time that they had really only spent 2 weeks together before they married. And that stuck with me, you know, from that era. And I don't think that's an uncommon story. I heard similar things from my mother. So that's kind of where that came from.
Well, I thought that was a great backstory because it puts a little bit different twist when you're dealing with somebody who's, you know, from France and, you know, being in the small town in anywhere is difficult, and challenging. So what's your story? Why did you want to get out of your town?
Why did I what?
You were born in a small town? Were you raised in a small town?
Oh, no, not necessarily. I was actually born in kind of a suburb of New York City. But I think kind of going back to just my experience in Texas on the ranch, and it was kind of the only time I spent with my dad, so of course that made it, you know, doubly impactful. Really, it's that's where Lenny and Caleb... That's where they were, and I just followed them. And I find when I'm writing with my characters, if I try to plan things out or outline too early, it just takes the life out of it. I just feel like my characters kind of stop what they're doing, put their hands on their hips, turn around, look at me, and say, "Would you just leave us be?" So
isn't that
I do that for a while.
That's a wonderful feeling when they take over.
It is.
I have a lawyer in 1875 who's taken over my mind for years, and I know he's not real. Okay, I know that. But at 5 in the morning when I am sitting there and I think he's, you know, in the corner looking at me and saying, "Why aren't you working on my story? You're supposed to be..." And I'm saying, "I'm doing other things right now."
Yeah, that's my favorite time to write also, early in the morning. I love that. And you're a writer. It takes a long time. It takes a lot of commitment. There's always the times where you're not sure if this is going to work or if this is going to connect with anybody. And what is it that, you know, keeps you going? And it's probably a different answer for everybody, but I think for me, I really fall in love with my characters, and I just feel this, in a way, this intimacy and this knowing. I know everything about them in a way that maybe sometimes one craves in our real life, but you can never really accomplish, right? Because everybody is their own autonomous person, and we connect to the best we can. But there's something about the intimacy we can have with our characters that's, I don't know, it's a beautiful thing.
Well, I have seen people who, you know, as I said, I've been around people who love horses, and you get this bond. Now, for me, I don't know why. Yeah. I never... I can't remember having a bad experience on a horse. We didn't have a horse in my grandfather's farm. I'm very close to cows.
I love cows too.
My grandmother's goat was I was the only other person my grandmother's goat wouldn't knock down. But somehow I never had that horse thing. Whereas for people who do, it is such a relationship. It's so strong.
Yes.
Like when Lenny is, you know, on Foggy, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I love this feeling that she's having, and this love that she has for her horse.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you feel that. I think my relationship with my horse is definitely a first love. And today, actually, I work with an organization. I'm a facilitator and trainer with an organization that works with horses and people coping with post-traumatic stress injuries, with veterans and first responders and people in recovery. And there really is an amazing connection between horses and people. It can be very, very grounding and healing, really.
Well, that's interesting, because my son's violin teacher actually did the same thing. He was a Dutchman from he had come here from Holland, and when he wasn't playing the violin, he was with his horses, training horses, working with horses, and he loved working with veterans and getting them on men who never were on a horse. But they and at first they would think, no, I'm, you know, it's a horse. give me a tank. You know, give me a jeep. But a horse. But boy, when they form that relationship, it's strong.
Yeah, it is. And I think one of the reasons that it's important work with people who are, you know, dealing with traumatic stress injuries is that it really gets us back into our bodies in an important way. So I could talk about it for a long time, but I won't.
But I think one of the things is when people are reading this, as I said, because you write so beautifully about horses, and you make it just... There's a romance in the horse too, you know. That's this love. When I think you form this special bond, and with the character's horse too. So it just, I thought it was great.
Yeah. Well, and the horses do play a role. I mean, they kind of bring the characters back together in New York City in 1986, and the novel concludes in the pre-pandemic current day, and horses play a little bit of a role there too. So we do leave Texas, but they never leave their love of horses.
And exactly. It's something that goes throughout the novel, and it's wonderful. I think it's beautifully written. You have written well. You know, it's just fun. I love a book. I love a book that's relaxing. It relaxes me. And as I'm reading this, and I'm thinking, you know, I almost like your breathing changes. It's not the same as when you're reading a thriller and there's going to be a murder or there's going to be... There's something so relaxing about a real love story, people connecting with each other. And as you said, it's, you know, takes us right, you know, through... near the pandemic. But nowadays, yes. I think people do need books like this, and I think the book is lovely. You've done a great job with it. And I wanted to ask you, spell your name for people. Donaldson.
Oh.
Well, it was so interesting. I got it wrong a couple of times. I'm writing it. I'm saying, no, I know, there's something wrong with this.
yeah, actually, my first name is spelled Donaldson, and I was named for my grandfather, for my father's father. I was the 16th grandchild, and no one had yet been named for him, so I got the honor. But when I was a girl, they called me Donna, you know, D-O-N-N-A. And so when I started going by Donaldson, I just kept the double N. You know, I don't know. I think I just wanted to be a little bit different. So, but my favorite response when people say, "That's your first name? Are you sure?" I've actually been asked that. It's like, yes, I'm pretty sure that's my first name.
Well, I think you are the only author with that first name. And it's
I am.
Actually, yeah. It's good because it's easy to find because, you know, if you have, I had one person on recently, I mean, everybody whose name had her name, and I said, oh, poor girl, she can't have a break, because people were actually, when they do, like on Facebook, and you put their name up, well, it's difficult to find them, but with...
Right.
Double N Donaldson. That's what you can be called, Double N Donaldson. It's a
lovely item. Right, like Patsy with a Z, and right. Double N Donaldson. So that's
easy way to, well, that's how people remember me. It's really strange.
Yeah, sure.
I'm waiting, I'm waiting for somebody to name a baby Patsy with a Z. I'm going to give them some kind of a prize if somebody will have a baby and name it Patsy. Not with any other name, just because Jimmy Hoffa gave me that name.
That's amazing.
So, if, you know, it's good enough for Jimmy Hoffa. It's good enough for some other baby, you know. And Donaldson with... two N's, Brown. Then it's nice when you have a simple last name.
Yes, that helps.
Yeah, it would have been really difficult if you had a four syllable last name. Then
yeah, that would have been too many syllables for sure.
but people can find you on the internet, and your book is available online. It's a lovely book, a sweet book, and I think an encouraging book, too, because we need to know that love can bloom and it's springtime and we need some happiness and joy, don't we?
Well, I hope it's a good story that people can sink into and that they like Lenny and Caleb at least as much as I do.
Well, I think they will. I think they will. And the book is called Because I Love You, and it's by Donaldson Brown. Everybody get it. Have a nice weekend. Just relax. Be happy. Think about horses and think about people being in love, falling in love, and finding love, right?
That sounds like a good plan to me.
Okay. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you.
Thank you, Patsy. All the best to you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. That's so sweet. Really, it is so sweet. Wonderful. You know, I've had a couple of love stories lately, and it's refreshing getting back to people who are in love and finding love, and just it's wonderful. And this book is very sweet. It's called Because I Love You, and beautifully written. She's very talented, and she's got a way with words, and it was nice. I enjoyed the part about Texas, and then also, as she said, when the part in New York City and in the arts community. A really great book. Anyway, so it's been a great day. And just think about that. If you would have a dinner party, who would you like to invite? What would you do if suddenly you could have a dinner party and invite anybody you wanted and that they'd accept it? And you know, the funny thing is you never know, because you might have an event or something. Just recently, somebody, who was it? Some famous singer was invited to somebody's wedding, and he showed up. Like, oh, well, you know, but you don't know unless you're going to try it. So you might as well try it and ask somebody to do something like that, or just for kicks, you know. I think what Leslie Karst did with this book, telling the story of how she created this menu for somebody to have a dinner party for somebody important and pulled it off. It's exciting, and it's you can just do a smaller dinner party. Dinner parties are fun. I'm glad that I got this book and got to talk about it, because as she writes in this book, the sort of there's that, when I talk about Joy on Paper, one of the things Joy in a cookbook. I love to read cookbooks. I have a lot of cookbooks, and I just open them up and read them, and I love to do that. So you might think about doing something like that, and having, it's time people get back out there and start living again. We've had too much of this pandemic-y years. They took a lot away from us. So I've been really thrilled with some of the books that I've gotten that are a bit more cheerful. I did not, everybody, just thank me so much. I did not review any of the pandemic-y books that had more pandemics, especially the ones with, oh gosh, I don't even want to say it. I got such pandemic-y books, but I didn't review any of them, did I? Did I invite any of them on? No, I did not, because I couldn't take it, and I didn't think you could take it. So I said, okay, I do not want to hear about it, especially those yellow leprosy ones. I'm glad I did not do those ones. We don't need it. We do need Bill Larson to come back, because Bill Larson is going to come back and at the end of the month and talk about some legal issues. People, please be careful. Please be careful. Don't click on anything when you get an email. And don't respond to any email from people asking you to send your book to them, because gee whiz, that's not the way that publishers or agents do it. They don't write to you. You have to write to them. And so they do not sort of just pull your name out of a magic bowl and say, oh, I'm going to write to you, somebody here in some little town, and I'm going to say, all you have to do is send me your book and $500, and I will get you a movie deal. Please don't do that. Please. But meanwhile, you should be writing, because maybe one day you'll find an agent too, or a great publisher who will take on your books, and then you will be a happy person like these two guests I had today. And particularly, I like this Donaldson Brown book. This was lots of fun. Anyway, everybody, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, to hear them spoken in audible book, or to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry. And her, well, Witch City Mysteries would be great, because she's got 13 books already. So we could get that one going. And Hallmark, wake up. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, for everything. And he saluted me. I saluted him, because I should have been a general. I certainly think like a general. I'm certainly as bossy as a general. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Bye-bye now.